on RN or online at abc.net.au. You're with Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. And still at the Council for Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences National Forum, let's take in highlights from the session, Does Australia Need a Chief Social Scientist? Making the case for one, here's Dr. Anne Moylan, historian of Australian science and technology and former director of the Science Policy Research Centre at Griffith University.
In 1959, the British novelist and physicist C.P. Snow, in his seminal book, The Two Cultures, dwelt on the danger of the increasing division that had grown up in the Western world since the Second World War between science and the humanities. More than 50 years later, such a separation is significantly more dangerous today. As Snow put it at that time, without a connection across the disciplines, we cannot think with wisdom. Well, in Europe, the term science is used to include both the enabling sciences of physics, astronomy, chemistry, mathematics, biology, and the social sciences and humanities, making a clear interconnection between the disciplines. In Australia, we differentiate these cultures and reserve the concept of science specifically for the hard sciences. Nationally, within the policy domain, science has been in the ascendant. The first chief scientist was appointed in 1989, and a Prime Minister's Science Council created that year, working with the chief scientist, as they put it, as the principal source of advice to government on issues of science and technology. In the mind of both government and public, an entrenched tendency has grown to look to science, the enabling sciences, to confront the challenges that face us in a turbulent and fast-changing world. Various voices have been raised in the last decades to claim a place for the humanities and social science in the shaping of Australia's national goals. In 2002, Professor Leon Mann, President of the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia, insisted, and I quote him, that social science knowledge and insight must partner natural sciences and technology concepts in the making of national policy. As he put it, truly national research priorities involve, in most cases, a combination of nature and society, environment and people, and the physical and the social. Earlier, Professor Margaret Mannion of the Academy of Humanities publicly highlighted the scholarly and interpretive role of the humanities and the arts as essential to ensure that we adopt policies with hindsight and wisdom. More recently, Tom Griffith, Professor of Environmental History at the ANU, having visited both the Arctic and the Antarctic, argued that though the public tended to define climate change as the domain of the natural and physical sciences, it is history, archaeology, anthropology, law, literature, art and politics that we must turn to, along with physics, astronomy, oceanography, chemistry, geology, medicine and meteorology. It is, he writes, not just scientists and science we will defer to. To date, government structures have strengthened the perception of the centrality of science. The Prime Minister's Science Council became the Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council, PIMSEC, in 1997, and was refashioned as the Commonwealth Science Council by the Abbott government last year. But while three invited members from the Academies of the Social Sciences and the Humanities sat variously with ministers and leading scientists on PIMSEC, the Commonwealth Science Council holds five representatives from STEM, that's the enabling sciences, and five representatives from the business community. There is no invited member from the HAS cultures. As the then president of the Academy of the Humanities, Leslie Johnson, protested, there is now no forum in which the government can access the expertise of the humanities, arts and social sciences. Yet, as she said, it is the HAS sector that will deliver the vital cultural, linguistic and social perspectives required for our future economic, political and cultural engagement in a global era. How then can social science and the humanities gain a greater presence in the making of national policy? At a time when all the national research priorities nominated this year by the new Commonwealth Science Council, such as food and water, transport, energy, resources, manufacturing and health, have their roots in social structure and human behaviour, the time for assessment is certainly due. In the last few years, the academies of the humanities and the social sciences have made conspicuous disciplinary and interdisciplinary contributions to the national knowledge base. Their collaborative Mapping the Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences in Australia, published in October 2014, provided a survey of the HAS disciplines in research, teaching and training in our universities and institutions, and revealed the particular knowledge and social understanding these disciplines generate. At a cross-disciplinary level, the Australian Council of Learned Societies launched its ACOLA project titled Securing Australia's Future, with substantial funding. This was in June 2012, with the purpose of delivering evidence-based research in support of ongoing and future-oriented policy development. The eight ACOLA reports to date, I just run across their titles because they're hard to round up, Australia's Agricultural Future, Smart Engagement with Asia, Technology and Australia's Future, Australia's Comparative Advantage, STEM Country Comparisons, The Role of Science Research and Technology in Lifting Australia's Productivity, Engineering Energy, Unconventional Gas Production, and importantly, Delivering Sustainable Urban Mobility. All of her very clear recognition of the importance of national interdisciplinary approaches and also of the particular relevance of HAS methodology in contributing to this great project of securing Australia's future. Here, the collaborative engagement between science and HAS marks a high development. But it is noteworthy that the reports, with their competent analysis and disciplinary integration, remain under the aegis of the chief scientist. Despite a collaboration at the research edge, the HAS disciplines have, as yet, no right of place or central presence in the government advisory system. Here, overseas experience can be instructive. A chief social scientist served for several years in the Scottish Parliament. Israel employs a chief scientist in the social sciences among its large clutter of chief scientists in government, and Canada has a chief social scientist who works in the environmental area. The United Kingdom appointed its first chief government social researcher with responsibility for promoting evidence-based policy in 2002. The appointee, Susan Duncan, an eminent civil servant with connections to academic and public sectors, when she was interviewed at the end of her time in office in 2008, offered a positive verdict. There have been, she said, substantial gains in creative review between policymakers and social scientists, and qualitative research had become an important part of policy evaluation, widely used to inform government policy design. In her conclusion, she emphasised that it was critical that the chief social researcher should operate at the policy centre and not be just the provider of data. The retirement of her successor, an eminent criminologist, Professor Paul Wiles, after 2 short years, drew strong recommendations from the Subcommittee on Science and Technology of the House of Lords on the need for a senior chief social scientist, as they put it, at the heart of government. The British Academy of the Social Sciences has long conducted a sustained debate on the question in their national campaign for the social scientists and in their important pre-election publication, The Business of People. So social science, they assert simply, is central to science. Their recommendation that a chief social scientist should be appointed to serve the Prime Minister, the Cabinet Secretary and government. It has won the support of 80 British universities, but is yet to be adopted by the UK government. But the most significant government development has initiative on the national place of social science and behavioural science has come this last September from the United States, where the President issued an executive order on the 15th of September under the title Behavioural Science Insights Policy Directive. Based on a growing body of evidence that demonstrates how behavioural science insights about how people make decisions and act on them can be used to design better government policies to serve the American people. President Obama directs his executive departments and agencies to identify policies, programs, and strategy that embrace knowledge and insights from the behavioural and social sciences, hoping that they may yield substantial improvements in public welfare, program outcomes, cost effectiveness, and even accelerate the transition to a low carbon economy. We have much to learn from this directive. The President's Social and Behavioural Science team will be attached to the National Science and Technology Council. So, against this backdrop, does Australia need a chief social scientist? Professor Stephen Swartz championed the idea of a chief social scientist to parallel the position of the chief scientist in his initial 213 CHASS newsletter. Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences, Professor Meredith Edwards, experienced in government and academia, in as early as 2009, advanced the notion of an academically qualified chief social scientist as a knowledge broker within government to link academic and government sectors and identify long-term approaches to wicked problems. And I have in general written and broadcast on the subject, and I'm always very surprised at the positive response. It so happened, I can drop a name here, coming up in the lift today, I ran into Professor Ross Garner, and I knew him in Canberra slightly. And I said to him as I was getting out of the lift, I said, well, I'm going to put forward a proposal today for the appointment of a chief social scientist. His whole face changed and lit up and looked very serious. He said, that's an absolutely excellent idea. So that was very encouraging.
Because he thinks it would be him.
Well, there is that possibility, though we don't really need an economist, do we?
No, we don't.
Anyhow, in my experience from what I've been talking about, there's certainly a rising commitment to the need for change. It's of interest to me that Catherine Livingstone, President of the Business Council and importantly a member of the Commonwealth Science Council, publicly addressed the need to assess our structural frameworks at the National Press Gallery in April. Many of our frameworks, she maintained, and I quote her, no longer fit. We need, and leaders must frame, a transition path which resonates the concerns people have, given the rapidly changing environment confronting us. How then do we affect change in the current policy structure? How can we adjust our policy frameworks to yield the most fruitful interaction between evidence-based social research and government policy. What mechanisms and processes are available? Professor Chubb's role as chief scientist offers an important model. His focus on the enabling sciences, on science education and training in the STEM arena, and on a national strategy for science has been conspicuous and impressive. He is a prominent advocate for science. HASS needs its own advocate. The appointment of an academically qualified chief social scientist offers an opportunity to bring the HASS disciplines as an equal participant to the policy table. Essentially, the appointment would require a knowledge broker capable of accessing ongoing research across disciplines which, it's worth emphasising, variously provide ways of understanding such key questions as natural resources, the impact of new technology and computerisation on employment, the nature of innovation in organisations, the environment, anthropogenic climate change, health and education, older people and ageing, urbanisation, ethics, and even such problems as shark attacks. And at core, strategic thinking about values, human behaviour and cultural attitudes. The title Chief Social Scientist offers one shorthand. But since an appointee would also represent the humanities, the title Chief Social Researcher is another option. Where to place such an official most usefully within the policy frame? In a department of government, in parallel with the chief scientist, or aligned with the chief scientist's office, where questions of parity and of independent and or collaborative responsibility would require definition? Well, this proposal for a chief social scientist, I will bring my talk to an end on this point, invites innovative boldness. In our early Federation days, Australia's history was characterised by a legislative boldness that won us international acclaim. Being old, I believe in boldness. We have a new government which emphasises imagination, innovation and a 21st century of fresh ideas. Professor Simon's message as president of CHASS is also highly positive. CHASS, he said, is looking to contribute to the creation of an inspiring Australia in which the establishment and role of a chief social scientist could take a lead in the design and development of evidence-based policy as a significant element in the articulation of knowledge and society. So it's time for serious discussion. Thank you.
Dr. Anne Moylan, historian of Australian science and technology and former director of the Science Policy Research Centre at Griffith University, making the case for a chief social scientist at the Council for Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences National Forum. On Big Ideas on RN, in the short time we have left, a couple of questions and responses from panel members. Australia's chief scientist, Professor Ian Chubb, and Professor Brian Head from the University of Queensland.
I would like to kick off the questions by asking what sort of advocacy work might be undertaken, for example, in terms of raising the profile of Australian SSH research in the international arena and also locally, in terms of really showing the value of the social sciences to the Australian economy.
I'll just throw in one thing that I'm worried about, that when I look at what's happening in the UK over the last 10 years and the role of, say, learned academies, just to take a narrow point, they have done an enormous amount of work to get their act together to give an account of themselves in terms of what I'm calling public value. And, I mean, I totally agree with what Ian's saying about we need to be able to demonstrate to the gardener and the taxi driver as well as to the Prime Minister that what we're doing is worthwhile. And we don't necessarily need the economistic metrics to prove it, but we need to have a convincing story. And those stories are appropriately different for different audiences. So I think we need to develop our messages much more carefully and comprehensively and make that material widely available, and for each of us as ambassadors or diplomats to be out there spruiking in our own different ways as much as we can. That would be a good starting point.
It would be great to have as an outcome from this session a method of constructing rather than deconstructing a reason for a chief social scientist. And I wonder, do you think, for example, that the UK approach in trying to sort of come back to that question of a chief social scientist through their campaign, is that the way to go here or not?
No, I think they have a big problem in Britain. When I read The Business of People, which is the work they brought out to convince the electorate before that last election, it's deadly prose. And there's no punch in it or nothing snappy, and I don't think they're successful in communication. But I personally think if you chose the right person to represent HAS or humanists or social scientists or whatever you might call them, then I don't see why they can't do as well as Professor Chubb does with science.
Well, and I will say, you mentioned that you thought that we were talking about sort of old-fashioned stuff here. And what about all of these societal challenges of radicalisation of youth, cyberbullying, over the internet, social media? That's a very real reason for having a chief social researcher.
Well, it's a very real reason to do research into those areas.
Exactly.
Whether or not, I don't know that they separately are a reason for having a chief social scientist. But I mean, I'm not dismissive of it. I mean, I think that the major role that the chief scientists of Australia have played over the years, and I hope also including me, is that we have learned how, and we've brought networks to the job, but we've learned how to connect people and to make sure that the right amount of knowledge with the right amount of evidence is pushed into the debate, the development of policy as best we can now. Oftentimes, as I said, you need passion and patience and persistence because it doesn't always work first time. But you know, from my scientific background, which stopped quite a while ago, it would be inconceivable that I could do my job properly if I wasn't well networked into the scientific community. There is no reason why a chief social scientist couldn't be equally well networked into the relevant disciplines and work well with the then chief scientist to be able to bring it together. What a government would not want is a chief scientist here and a chief scientist over here, one of them with a languid flick of the wrist saying, oh, you know, ignore it, you know, we're the real deal or whatever. So you actually, the people, so you shouldn't have a structure that's based on people, but the people that populate your structure are important. And how they work together is critical. But I don't think it's an issue of dismissing it. I think there is a strong case for it, but you'd have to make the case quite carefully.
I think the key thing coming out of it is, in fact, this knowledge brokering point. I think the literature I've been involved in the last decade or so is all pointing in the direction that it's not about digging ever deeper trenches with more and more data. It's actually about capacity to intelligently link things together and know where to look, as Ian said before. And certainly, going back to the previous question, one of the key success factors for a chief social person would be their network capacities and their ability to draw on best available expertise to help address particular issues. And I mean, I think the other thing I threw off was the idea that if this ever happened, and if a fantastic woman was appointed who could actually do the job really well, one of the surprising sort of expansions of the role would be to create something out of, in effect, nothing, because at the moment, we are not training our senior people to have these capacities. They're not particularly rewarded for it. People who have some of those necessary capacities often end up doing other sorts of things, like being a vice-chancellor or something like that. The academies I mean, I don't have enough experience of the academies to know whether you can generalise about levels of energy there, but I don't see them as necessarily high energy level things, which are kind of like creating dozens of these people to play those sorts of roles. Yeah, it's a difficult thing, but the knowledge brokering point's really, really important.
Professor Brian Head from the University of Queensland and Professor Ian Chubb, the outgoing chief scientist, responding to Dr. Anne Moylan's presentation and the case for a chief social scientist. Our thanks to CHASS, the Council for Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences, for providing audio of tonight's sessions from their recent national forum.